I used to love the Terence Hill, Bud Spencer films.
My Name Is Nobody and...
Watch Out, We're Mad. Yeah, there's a whole heap of them.
They did a lot,
I think,
yeah.
One of the hallmarks of those spaghetti westerns was the dubbing of English. In fact, most of the audio was post-produced.
Yeah, perhaps we should explain what this genre was. You could probably guess from the name, but they were Italian westerns, often starring European or like American movie stars, but they would... It was part of their standard of that recording process that they would dub it all in post-production. And so a lot of the time, you know, the actors on the film would be speaking different languages. And so the whole kind of audio mix would be done in post, hence like a lot of the hallmarks of it, not just the dubbing of the dialogue, but also these like crazy sound effects that they would use.
Yeah, the filmmaking process was different back in those early days. They didn't have the ability to capture live sound, and they were probably limited by budget as well. So it was just easier to do all of the audio afterwards. They still do that these days in a lot of productions. But the of course, the Wild West existed everywhere. It wasn't just in America, but most of our most of the stories we're familiar with all come out of Hollywood, all of those classic American westerns. But the same kind of thing was going on everywhere. Of course, in Australia, we had our Wild West at the same period of time. And in a lot of these stories, they're really retelling the characters that were set up in books, I guess, that were then made into movies, all these famous Wild West characters. But the spaghetti westerns seemed to have a slightly different take on it. They really were, the characters in those stories were not so much famous people that actually existed, but they were like archetypes of people.
Absolutely, and with that sort of Italian stylistic approach, what we see with the spaghetti western, similar to what the Italians were doing in horror at the same time, it's like they're using the sort of the architecture, the mythology as a jumping off point, but then they do something with it that's more hyper real or like more heightened and over the top. So you've got these like super... These archetypal characters sort of become almost superhuman, larger than life.
Yeah, and these Clint Eastwood spaghetti westerns are a great example, particularly this one, because the main characters are Clint Eastwood himself, who is nicknamed Blondie. Yeah, Blondie. And then there's Angel Eyes, who's the bad. He's the bad guy. And then there's the other host of characters. The main one's Tuco.
Yes.
Who's a key character in the film and probably the most real.
He's the ugly. Because it comes up with title cards at the beginning.
It's a pretty ugly place. The period it's set in is during the Civil War.
Yes. So the title comprises these three central characters, like all representing these different archetypes: the good, the bad, and the ugly. And that was something that almost like a comic book or something, or like a very old timey kind of entertainment, the way that it shows that sets that all up for you at the beginning of who these guys are, what archetypes they represent. And so
it's like the Roadrunner.
Yeah, exactly. It's super Looney Tunes. That's something we were saying with Leone. And Clint Eastwood is kind of like Bugs Bunny in that he's more sort of aloof, like observing kind of mode. And I guess like Tuco is like he's like the Wile E. Coyote or something, this kind of scheming,
he
hungry
is
character. Like,
yeah. And he, but he's always messing up, and he's always doing stupid things, and he's a very human character.
Yes, the most relatable of the three, and I mentioned Tuco the Ugly. He's played by Eli Wallach, a terrific actor, and our villain Angel Eyes is Lee Van Cleef, who Sergio Leone had worked with before, also in the previous of the Dollar Trilogy, the A Few Dollars More. With both Eastwood and Lee Van Cleef in there. And it's set during, yes, this era of the American Civil War, and I suppose the three characters are brought together on this, like, treasure hunt, where they're sort of adversarial.
That's it. It's the search for lost treasure.
Yes.
Gold.
Yeah. So super mythological kind of story. You know, this is a story that's as old as time.
Buried treasure.
Yes, yes. It's interesting how the character Tuco, who is ugly, as we've said, he ends up being the most human character. He portrays the largest emotional kind of range and register.
Yeah, well, the other characters don't really display any emotion at all.
Yes.
Tuco is... he's just full of all the human emotions.
Yeah.
He's scared, and he's arrogant, and he's a braggart, and he's a thief, and he lies constantly throughout the movie. And but he's also very sentimental, you know, in those the part where his brother, who's a minister, he's kind of a torn. He's very human. He's torn with all these mixed emotions and desires, and you know, the search for the buried treasure is a big part of that.
And this is something that I found as a kid, like bringing it into the archetypes of like Looney Tunes, is the Wile E. Coyote character is the much more relatable character because he wants something, and anyone can relate to that because we all want something, and we all will try to, like, put steps towards, you know, orchestrating something. And whereas all the Roadrunner does is run around and say, meep, meep, you know, and just, like, he's kind of more of a, like, an elemental spirit or something. And the coyote is the character who's grounded in this, like, very human hunger.
It is very similar because Blondie is just riding around on his horse. And although he gets... well, he's a central player in this search for this treasure. He doesn't seem to have very much invested in anything that happens.
Yes, yeah, he's not reactive.
Same with Angel Eyes.
Yes.
I mean, he just kind of indiscriminately kills people and is obviously after the treasure. But it's only really Tuco who really displays any kind of...
relatable motivation.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that his character is deemed ugly, and as we've said, he's the most human, and so does that reflect the fact that our human needs and desires are on some level ugly? Is a sort of raw revelation of our hungry, questing selves something that makes us uncomfortable or makes us embarrassed?
Yeah, well, they don't really showcase the beautiful in that film, although, you know, the Wild West is a beautiful setting, and the natural world is a beautiful place. It's not really a theme that's explored at all in that film. One of the things I love about Westerns is the world presented in a Western, this idea of unannexed territories, you know, the unexplored wilderness and all the opportunity. And
it's definitely a setting that is very charged with epicness and adventure and romanticism
and possibility. You know, it's the world we live in now. Everything seems to be mapped and measured and quantized. I mean, we're presented with the idea that there isn't anywhere that we haven't sort of crawled all over.
Yes.
And that's a different world that's presented in these Westerns and these spaghetti Westerns.
Yeah. That's a big ingredient as to why probably the genre was so enduringly popular for so long, and how it kind of tapped into an idea of the sort of American pursuit of happiness, like this idea of carving out your little slice of heaven within the land that you stumble across. I used to watch a lot of Westerns with my grandfather. He loved Westerns. I guess as we get older, we get more set in our ways, but he was much more inclined towards Westerns than, say, like a cop type story or a gangster story or a military type thing. Like, he'd still watch those as well, but he'd much more gravitate towards a Western. He'd always ask for that. And I think there's something about the setting. There's something about the mythology and the imagery of these wide open spaces and these huge hats that people are wearing and the guns. And once you see the people ride up on horseback and the train come through, there's just something fundamentally exciting about it and adventurous. And so you can take the kind of story that might, you know, be the same kind of story in a cop show, but you put it in a Western setting and automatically it feels more epic. And it gives like it paints like the characters cast bigger shadows, shall we say. I don't know, John, you're doing a very skeptical face there.
No, not at all. I was just thinking on a tangent, that's all. I'm thinking, why do I love them? And it's the horses and the way people get around. I've had a bit of a theme for a while now about how I wish the world was full of horses like it used to, because with my vision problems, I can't drive a car, and it's dangerous for me even walking around with someone else, because I just don't have the vision to be able to cope with all those randomly moving stuff. And the great thing about a horse is he's clever. You know, and it knows where to go most of the time. You don't even have to steer it if you're going to the same place. If I could have a horse now, it would really change my world as far as me being able to get around. But of course, a horse doesn't fit in to the situation I'm in, where I live.
That's right.
You couldn't have a horse in the city and ride around.
No.
The poor thing, you'd get terrified.
That's right. It's not viable. And I think that something that some Westerns and some pirate movies actually capture this very theme is this idea that with mapping, with the kind of cartography of everything, if you look at that as some kind of like a control grid, well, this is actually a force that takes the magic out of the world. It takes the mystery out of things, and it makes things more like a sort of less romantic, more humdrum kind of world. On the topic of spaghetti westerns, Quentin Tarantino actually took the name Django from a very popular spaghetti western series from the 60s. It wasn't a black character in that, but so for Tarantino's Django Unchained, it's spelt the same way with the silent D at the beginning. And Django was this character, he was kind of like this dark hero, this kind of dark avenging angel, and he kills a lot of people. He's one of those characters that would just mow people down and never has to reload, kind of thing. And he in the first Django movie, at least that's the only one I've seen, but there was heaps of them. But in the first one, he carries around this coffin behind him, because he's kind of like, he's resurrected himself, he's come back to get revenge. And so other popular ones would be I believe we mentioned the Terrence Hill and Bud Spencer movies, like
Watch Out, We're Mad, and
My Name is Nobody, They Call Me Trinity.
Yeah, Trinity, the Trinity films, yeah.
And so they made heaps of those movies, and they were a really enduring duo. There were certain actors that were very associated with it, so
they were huge. Now, I do remember those films, because they came out in the early 70s, and I was a cinema goer by that stage, a young teenager, and I can remember going to the Singleton Cinema, which was a marvelous experience back in those days. It had the guy playing the organ that used to come out of the floor at the beginning, and you always had another short film or something on beforehand. There were usually two showings and then like an intermission. It was a different world to the cinema experience now. But I quite vividly remember seeing the Trinity movies, and along with the Bruce Lee movies that came out at the same time.
Kung Fu. Well, something that spaghetti westerns, I think, actually did for the genre is that they brought a sense of epicness and grandeur back into the genre, because when Westerns first started, they were these very epic scales about wars and victories and fighting the Indians, fighting the English, whatever. And they'd have these big elaborate action scenes and battle scenes and set pieces with robbers running along the top of trains, whether it's these famous, like the Dalton, these various famous outlaw type of gangs. And that kind of lasted throughout the silent movies and the 30s and the 40s, these big epic adventures. I'm talking about Hollywood. And then what happened in the 50s in Hollywood is that Westerns kind of pulled back and started to become more psychological, more introspective. You've got movies like High Noon, where it's all about this sheriff guy who just, he's trying to stand his ground and protect the town, but he can't find anyone in the town to help him. So it paints quite a dark picture. And also with The Searchers, with John Wayne from 1956, like in that movie, his granddaughter's been like captured and adopted by the Indians, his daughter, sorry, and he's trying to like find her, not to rescue her, but kill her because she's been like corrupted by their influence from his like racist point of view. So we have these very dark, more psychological Westerns in the 50s, and they kind of lost that sense of adventure and became more like character pieces. And then what the 60s, like what the spaghetti, the boom of the spaghetti Westerns, they brought back that massive scope and that sense of the high adventure to the genre that had been lacking.
Yeah, those 50s Westerns were like Sons and Daughters or something. I can definitely remember watching those, you know, when I was a kid in the early 70s, watching a lot of those old 50s films, and I didn't really like them very much, the Westerns. They were a completely different experience.
Yeah, those 50s ones, in a way, like the tone of them, it does lack a lot of what we associate for a Western. There'll be these more kind of darker tales about, and normally, yeah, more focused on a smaller scale as well. And it, yeah, it's interesting to note that the Western genre itself, there's a considerable decline in productions in the 70s. And maybe a lot of the Western archetypes and themes get repurposed for some of, you know, your 80s blockbuster type action heroes, like maybe some of your Stallone or Arnie movies are just Westerns with a different outfit if you look at, you know, some of the archetypes at play. But it is interesting that they become considerably less popular, to a point today when Westerns, I mean, you hear movie critics saying there's all these great indie Westerns coming out, but no one watches them. We have become somewhat removed from this mythology. Perhaps there's a lot of revisionist history that says that time was nothing but bad, you know, nothing but racism and subjugation and human life being treated very cheaply. So the narrative has been reframed in the West, you know, around these American archetypes. Maybe that's got something to do with it. It's quite fitting, John, that you referred to those 50s Westerns as being like Sons and Daughters, because there was a term that was applied to those style of Westerns. They called them a horse opera. And a lot of them were like these kind of soap operas on a horse. And so there'd be these kind of stories about, oh, the overprotective rancher doesn't want his daughter to get married to this guy, and he wants his son to stay in the family business kind of thing. So they kind of, a lot of them were not these kind of stories of big adventures. So yeah, it's a very different vibe.
Yeah, it's kind of like just set in a Western setting, but not with the gunfighters and the,
what we associate with the Western
archetypal good guys and bad guys, yeah, kind of dueling and chasing treasure, and you know,
that's it.
More mundane, sort of realistic.
Yeah.
Storylines.
That's it. So, in The Good and the Bad and the Ugly, you have these, yeah, as we've said, these three characters. But really, as you said, John, we are all like Tuco. And Angel Eyes and Blondie, they're like
superhumans.
Yes, yeah.
Not real people, larger than life. Yeah, with mysterious powers and almost like, you know, angels or devils, you know.
A lot of the time in Westerns as well, you get characters, and it could be a hero or a villain, but you get characters that embody the archetype of the trickster, a sort of opportunistic character who will exploit situations to his advantage and manipulate and not really be like seemingly tethered and grounded in the same way that that other people are. But I just want to give a little shout out to I think a really terrific Korean film, and so this is a movie from 2008 called The Good, the Bad, the Weird, and it's obviously overtly inspired by the Sergio Leone movie within its premise and within the archetypes of the characters. They use a different setting. They make it Manchuria in 1939. Manchuria, this was a puppet state of the Japanese Empire in China that only existed from 1932 to 1945. But and it's set just before World War II. So essentially, these three characters, so there's a bandit who is the good, a hitman who is the bad, and the weird is a thief. But it basically plays out in the same kind of way, with the same kind of character dynamics as the Leone film, where the good and the bad character are the less emotional. But the weird character, it's weird rather than ugly in this. He's the guy that is more relatable, shows more fear and joy, and just more of a range of human emotion. But it's interesting that him being the most humanistic character is identified as weird. And it leads me to thinking how we are all weird with our unique idiosyncrasies and personalities and needs and these kind of things. And so the human experience on its, in its more kind of raw form is weird and it's ugly at times. And so, yeah, it's interesting how these two respective films categorize that and play with that. And yeah, I'd recommend checking them out. As time goes on, and we mentioned before how Westerns were less popular in the 70s, and something that does happen in the 70s, as well as the establishing of like the big mega blockbusters like your Jaws and your Star Wars, but what we really do get a lot of in the 70s is more nihilistic kind of films, because back in the old Hollywood times, movies were, at least after the mid-30s when they brought in the codes of conduct, movies were obliged to have happy endings and have a moral, to have punishment of the wickedness. So the film noir movies, if they had like an evil protagonist, he'd have to get his comeuppance in the end, kind of a thing. And what we see more in the 70s is that there's much more dark nihilistic movies. Like, you ever watch like a lot of 70s movies, you start to see that a lot of these movies end with senseless kind of violence and brutality. Like, it's almost like they went the opposite way.
I can remember that happening. Land of the Giants sticks out in my mind, because it was a very dark, weird, brooding the world. I mean, it very was sinister. Kind of a science fiction. It was meant to be another place that was almost like the world we live in, but it wasn't, because it was full of giants and these normal people were there and they were tiny, but it was really dark and sinister themes and atmosphere to the whole thing. Really creepy.
And this is something that, definitely gets propagated. It might have happened in tandem with the sort of America's loss of innocence after the 60s, with things like going on like the JFK shooting and like Charles Manson murders and stuff like that, but
and the start with all the weird MK Ultra stuff with the
Manchurian candidates and
with the government actually getting interested in experimenting on populations in all kinds of ways. Now, not that governments have always been interested in the manipulation of the masses. That's what they're all about.
There's some great movies with these kind of themes as well. I mean, it's the idea of like mind control, brainwashing. It's absolutely rife within the espionage genre and action movies to do with the military and stuff. It's super prolific within that genre, and that stuff really does kick into gear in the 60s with these ideas of like the programmed to kill mind controlled assassins.
Yeah, Charles Manson and manipulation of that whole acid phase. To what purpose? I'm not exactly sure. Did the government get involved in these kinds of experiments?
Yeah. And we start to see movies that reflect a kind of idea. So the archetype of the hero definitely changes in this era as well, in this kind of... Because the Bond movies start in the early 60s, and what we start to see throughout the 60s and 70s is... Because a hero used to represent someone who stands up for the talents and the values of the culture, whether that's like the protection of the innocent and family or whatever the kind of the more kind of traditional conservative kind of American ideals.
The good guy was a hero.
Yeah.
And he was a good guy.
Yeah. Before Bond, you didn't have heroes who would shoot people, who would shoot unarmed people in the back. And what Bond represents, if you look at his, what drives him, he's very shallow in a lot of ways in his pursuit of gadgets and women and watches and cars and these kind of things. And so he kind of represents a very atomized man who's more materialistic. And we see this kind of character replicated from that then on in like lots of cop movies. It's just, becomes, so it's a kind of a new style of hero that's more edgy, more austere, not as much of a clear-cut kind of good guy. The 80s was more of a return to less moral ambiguity. The 80s was a return to... Because there was that sort of, like, that Reaganism in Hollywood, those more kind of family values going on, at least in terms of what was paid lip service to. And so we do get movies with more traditional sort of morality in the 80s and more happy endings than the 70s.
I gotta tell you, I love a happy ending. And on that note, we'll say goodbye for this week.
We hope you've enjoyed joining us for this show, and we will be back.
Indeed.
I'm Riley.
And I'm John.
Sayonara for now.
We'll catch you later.
Tell you to run.
All the way. All the way.
From moment to see, moment to on.
You're listening to People Powered Radio, proudly supported by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. The Community Broadcasting Foundation resources community-owned and operated media stations just like this one that connect people and tell vital, local stories so that we all enjoy a more vibrant, inclusive Australian culture and healthy democracy. Find out more about our work at cbf.com.au.
I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land in which we broadcast, the Gadigal, the Bidjigal, and the Birrabirragal. We extend our acknowledgement to mob all across the nation. We pay respects to elders past, present, and future. We acknowledge that sovereignty was never ceded. Always was, always will be, Aboriginal land.
You are tuned to Eastside Radio 89.7 FM, broadcasting from Gadigal land on the Eora Nation, Paddo Town Hall, Sydney. And thank you so much, Breaking Waves, for your program. Love listening to your work. And welcome to Planet Romanistan, a program that celebrates Romani Kale Vlach Tom Lom Manush Sinti Romani Shal or Gypsy music and culture from around the planet. And I'm your super privileged host, Sarah Bedak, from the Sydney-based band Lola Lavina. It's my absolute pleasure to be here tonight and to share Romani music with you from around the world. Lacho divers sarenge tumenge mangav tumenge but bach taisas tipe. Tonight on Planet Romanistan, we're going to feature music from film and television,